Welcome to Morning Report Top Stories, a selection of news from RNZ's Morning News Programme. Stuart Nash has been sacked from all of his ministerial portfolios following a breach of cabinet rules. Mr. Nash was already on a final warning before a Stuff Media report last night revealed he'd emailed details of cabinet discussions to two businessmen who were also his donors in 2020. Mr. Nash emailed business associates in 2020 when the government was negotiating a commercial rent relief package. He said he had lost an argument at the cabinet table and disclosed his colleagues' views. The Prime Minister last night condemned Mr. Nash's actions.
This is a clear breach of cabinet's collective responsibility and cabinet confidentiality. Stuart Nash has fundamentally breached my trust and the trust of his cabinet colleagues. His conduct is inexcusable.
Now, Chris Hipkins said Stuart Nash's actions raised a perception of influence that cannot be allowed to stand, and he had no choice but to sack him.
In recent weeks, I've sought and been given assurances from Stuart that there were no other instances or allegations of misconduct that I should be aware of. While Stuart was on a final warning, I want to be clear that this incident alone would have resulted in his dismissal in its own right. I consider the matter to be a very serious one.
Well, our political editor Jane Patterson joins us now. Good morning, Jane.
Good morning, Corey.
As we heard there from the Prime Minister, this alone was so serious it would have cost him his job. Just let's go through a little bit what exactly the rules are that he has broken in this instance.
So in Cabinet, you have obviously a lot of thorny issues that Cabinet ministers have to discuss. So they get round the Cabinet table. That's the point that if you have any opposition, if you want to raise arguments, if you want to raise alternative proposals, you debate it out, you discuss it. Now, once that decision has been accepted or adopted by the Cabinet, that's it. It's called Cabinet collective responsibility kicks in. And that means no matter how strongly you feel about that decision, you have to go out and back it publicly.
That is a very important principle in terms of our system.
Important core principle in terms of stability of the government, decision making, all of those sorts of things. So that's number one. Confidentiality is the second one. You don't leak cabinet discussions and specifics like the names of your cabinet colleagues who you were talking about, and basically giving outsiders, people also interested in this policy change, details of what had gone on and the positions of various ones. So confidentiality. And as Chris Hipkins alluded to yesterday, there were probably a number of other breaches when you look at acting professionally, acting ethically. This is such an egregious breach. I really struggle to remember a breach of cabinet manual so serious as this one.
Now, let's remember Stuart Nash was on a final warning. Did he had... The Prime Minister had asked him whether there were any other skeletons in the closet that he needed to come out with at that point. Did he just not think about this? He didn't. Why didn't he see that this was a breach? I mean, he's an experienced cabinet minister.
And Stuart Nash has gone to ground. He has not been talking, so we're not sure about the motivation. But he was on final notice. In fact, I'd say he'd stretched the limits of Chris Hipkins in terms of tolerance over a number of incidents that came out through the media, and then one Stuart Nash admitted to the Prime Minister himself. This was another media investigation by Stuff that came out late last night. So the Prime Minister had absolutely no choice. That was clear. Interestingly, he said last night too that Stuart Nash didn't put up a fight. He offered his resignation, but Chris Hipkins would not accept it. He said he would dismiss him. So, you know, you have situations where ministers can go out and they can say, I resigned. No, he was sacked in this one. And Chris Hipkins was obviously, he said himself, he was gutted. This is a long-term colleague of Chris Hipkins. They both came into Parliament together in 2008. They've been through a lot together, but it was black and white.
I mean, Christopher Luxon has likened this to insider trading. Is that a reasonable sort of comparison?
It's certainly pushing the boundaries in terms of like the cabinet expectations on a minister. Insider trading is, I suppose, more normally in a business kind of sense. So it's more
there was no financial gain.
There was no financial gain and no personal gain. So that's the
for
difference.
For Stuart Nash.
For Stuart Nash. That's the difference. So, yes, it was completely and utterly inappropriate for him to be having this kind of conversation, email conversation with outsiders, and then that ramps up even more because they were donors to his campaign. So whichever way you turn it, it was just, as I said, an egregious breach.
Now, the Prime Minister last night,
situation.
Too, was quick to point it out that the businessmen involved, they'd done nothing wrong.
Yes.
And that they were getting the information after the event, right? The Cabinet had made the decision.
That's right. That's right. But it doesn't alleviate the breach. It alleviates, I suppose, the potential for the Cabinet discussions to have been influenced if there was a, you know, if Stuart Nash had brought back some response from them into the Cabinet table. So that limits that. But actually, the breach itself on principle doesn't make any difference to.
There is a perception issue here that is a big problem too. And is there going to have to be a probe, a look back at other decisions and arguments and things to restore some confidence that there haven't been other instances where Stuart Nash has felt the need to share?
Yes, I absolutely think this needs further investigation. You've got a cabinet minister now. This is 3 years ago. His other interactions in terms of the police and immigration that he'd already been in hot water show a pattern of behaviour. It shows he is fast and loose with the rules. He has held senior and significant portfolios. And as I said, this one was from 2020. So what's happened in the interim, what's happened in the 3 years, in terms of his conduct as a cabinet minister. Now, he's gone, so it's not about him. It's actually about the confidence in the government in terms of having a minister. What else had he done? Now, it's a difficult exercise because what boundaries do you put around it? I mean, all of his communications, it's a big field if you look at it. However, I do think there's a matter of public confidence here. Chris Hipkins was asked about it yesterday. He said it's not his job to investigate. He has done his job by removing Stuart Nash. He did make a comment about others do have the remit. So I mean, we've got the Auditor General and organisations like that, but that is something that Mr Hipkins will have to make a decision on. If he does, it could open a whole can of worms, or he could just say, no, it's done. And then, of course, we have the situation of Stuart Nash now, not a minister. He did text us last night saying that he was not going to quit his Napier seat and force a by-election. National's Christopher Luxon came out really fired up last night. He wanted him gone last night from Parliament. However, in a couple of weeks' time, if there was a resignation from that seat, he wouldn't actually have to have a by-election because of the general election. And Jacinda Ardern's in that situation too. So, you know, it seems a bit ridiculous for him, for calls for him now to step down or vacate that seat.
Yes. That said, his future in the Labour Party, is that up in the air?
I think that's pretty much over. Chris Hipkins said last night that he had asked Stuart Nash to reflect on his future with the party, and that's basically like, go away, have a think about not coming back, and come back and tell me when you're ready to tell me that, because there is just so much trust destroyed, I think, within the Cabinet and his really close senior colleagues in Labour. I find it very difficult.
I mean, just finally, Joan, this is destabilising for any government to lose a minister. You know, in an election year, it's distracting, it's putting Chris Hipkins in difficult situations. This is not where the government wants to be.
No, it is not. The only thing I would say, it was dealt with very swiftly. There was no mucking around yesterday.
Well,
it was probably helped by the fact that it was such an egregious breach. The Prime Minister
didn't have any.
He might be
wishing he had done it earlier with the other breaches.
Right. That's right. And I suppose he now has to. The issue for Chris Hipkins are these calls for an inquiry, how he handles them. Stuart Nash was dealt with pretty swiftly, pretty brutally, but the political risk now will be in defending the way that Cabinet has been run, defending the integrity of Cabinet ministers, and proving that actually there haven't been any other conduct that would compromise that.
Jane Patterson, thank you very much for that analysis. That was our political editor, Jane Patterson.
The Green Party co-leader and Minister Marama Davidson is adamant she will not apologise over her comment that it is white cis men who cause violence in the world. Now, for those wondering, we have had a number of people texting in. Cis is short for cisgender. It effectively means transgender. She made the comments after being confronted by a far-right activist on Saturday, about half an hour after being struck by a motorcycle at a trans rights rally in Auckland. Ms. Davidson told First Up earlier the important takeaway was that trans people were not a threat to women's safety in New Zealand.
I was hit by the motorcycle when I first turned up to the protest.
Yeah.
So I got hit and then being really hurt but didn't want to give up my commitment to speak at the rally, so went and did that. And then on the way back to the car was massively ambushed by the right-wing Hannah Spears, who's also in court, you know, went to court for sharing white supremacist material. I have clarified that I don't normally use those words or that language, but I always talk about ending the patriarchy. I always talk about the structures of power and that the drivers of violence, we cannot end violence without recognizing the structures of power. Yeah. And, you know, so I don't move away from what I was trying to highlight and the fact that the biggest threat to women is definitely not trans people.
To be clear, cisgender means not transgender, in case I missed that critical word not earlier. In response to calls from the National Party leader, Christopher Luxon, for her to apologise or to resign, Marama Davidson had this to say.
I'd like him to help end violence and to help all men take responsibility for when men are violent and to be accountable. I'd like us to actually use this spotlight to actually talk about the solutions, a prevention, strength-based approach to ending violence. I am not going to apologise to cis men, no. The Greens and I am really unequivocally clear about non-violence and upholding non-violence. The protest was about rallying for a group and a community of people, our trans whānau, who have been persecuted, oppressed, targeted and hated and discriminated against for generations and decades. And the rally was a beautiful show of solidarity. So while you have quite a lot of sort of keyboard warriors in the background and trolls, who actually shows up? Not Posy Parker's people, not that division and hate, the thousands and thousands who showed up around the country. My goodness, Wellington, you're amazing. The very next day, Christchurch, Dunedin, cute little picnics and rallies around the whole country in smaller towns. That's who shows up. That's who's real. And that's what Aotearoa is really clear about. We won't accept your offshore threats to our democracy. We've got beautiful kaupapa Māori values here, and they are the stronghold against that rubbish, and I'm really proud of it.
The Green Party co-leader and Minister Marama Davidson there speaking to First Up. Secondary teachers are taking to the streets today, less than 2 weeks after the last strike. Pay rises and improvements to work conditions are part of their demands. Today's picketing comes ahead of more serious action planned for Term 2, where teachers will reduce their labour to protest at the lack of progress in negotiations. Chris Abercrombie is the acting president of the Post-Primary Teachers Association. Kia ora, good morning.
Good morning.
Can I start by asking how many days have students at your school had off this year already due to strikes, due to teachers' only days or other disruption?
At my school, 1 day so far, and then obviously today, so 2 days.
What about in Auckland? Because I know they have experienced quite a bit more disruption this year.
Yes, and we absolutely recognise the disruption that many schools are facing, but what's more disruptive is not having subject specialist teachers in front of them. We've been in negotiations for almost a year before we've got to this point. So it's about getting it sorted.
By my count, some of those students have had as many as 7 days off due to weather, then another 2 days now for strikes, adding in those teacher-only days. Is now really the right time, given the disruption, the flooding, the pandemic last year and the like, is now really the time for more disruption?
There's never the right time for disruption, and this is not something that teachers have taken lightly, but it just shows their commitment to ensuring that we have specialist subject teachers in front of our students today and in 5, 10, 15 years, because at the moment there's no guarantee.
put the current offer into context for us. We're talking a lump sum, $6,000 over 2 years. What is that as a percentage for say, a beginning teacher and then at the upper end?
So at the upper end, it's around 6% over 2 years, and at the lower end, it's around 10% over 2 years.
If the ministry offered you a 7% bump this afternoon across the board, cost of living, would that solve the problem?
I can't answer that question. It's up for our membership to decide, but we are asking for a CPI increase over the term of the collective agreement. So any movement in that area would be welcome.
Well, that's 7%, isn't it? CPI
7.2, yeah, and then yeah. 6. So yeah, I mean, it would almost, you're right, that would solve a lot of the issues, but I can't say that would be okay because it's up to the membership to decide.
That wouldn't be as much then for those beginning teachers.
Well, we're asking for 7.2 and then 6.2, so it would be more for beginning teachers.
Right. How far away are you, do you think, from getting to an agreement to getting to that level with the government?
I don't think we're that far away. There's been some really positive movement in some areas, but there are some sticking points, and pay is one of those sticking points. And so this industrial action just shows the resolve of the teachers to get this sorted and demonstrates to the government how important this is to us.
How critical is the pay? Is that really what this is about? I know that we often say it's not all about the pay, or teachers say it's not all about the pay, and I know that, but critically, the pay is important, right?
Oh, absolutely. The pay is important. I mean, as you know, there's other parts to our claim around conditions of partial care, recognising our Māori and Pacifica teachers, but pay is a part of it. Teachers have not had a pay rise since July 2021, and things have got a lot more expensive. And if we want to recruit and retain teachers in this amazing job, we're going to have to pay them properly. You know, having an amazing job doesn't pay the mortgage.
The other big issue around staffing and retention, teaching assistants and the like, there's no easy, quick fix to that, is there?
No, there's not. And there's absolutely not a quick fix. But the quickest fix is retention, retaining the teachers we have. And then the next step is bringing the teachers, ex-teachers who have left, back into the profession. And pay and conditions are a significant part of that. And then we need to work on recruitment. And that's, you know, bringing in potentially teachers from overseas. But the long-term solution is growing our own teachers here in New Zealand.
What next?
And what industrial action is next?
And when?
So term two, we'll be engaging in more industrial action if there's not a suitable settlement, and that'll be from week two of term two. We'll be rostering home students. So various certain year levels won't be taught on certain days. More detail will come from schools around that.
Chris, thank you for your time. That is Chris Abercrombie, the Acting President of the Post-Primary Teachers Association.
A record-breaking number of people are taking part in a 10th day of mass protests in France. An estimated 500,000 people have taken the streets over pension reforms, and things look to have escalated in the last few hours. Fires have been started and tear gas has been thrown at some demonstrations in Paris. Some 13,000 police officers, many in riot gear, are deployed across the country. With us now from Paris is our correspondent, Sarah Coates. Sarah, this is escalating. Why is the government, or in particular Emmanuel Macron, pushing on with this reform in the face of such opposition?
Yes, hello there, Corinne. Lovely to speak with you. Well, look, the Macron government says that this pension reform is absolutely necessary to keep the system afloat. What we're seeing here right across the country is an ageing population. And the Macron government argues that the system simply cannot keep providing what it does without people working this extra 2 years. That would be moving the pension system from 62 to 64 with a full pension. But, you know, as you just mentioned, there is simply so much opposition to this. The French really hold this pension system very close to their heart. Working another 2 years simply isn't an option for most people. 7 out of 10 people who've been surveyed said that they completely disagree with this. You know, despite Macron, that being one of his key election promises and him being voted in on that. But, you know, as you mentioned, it is more than 2 months now of strikes, another one planned for next Thursday. And, you know, we're still seeing huge numbers. Last week, Corinne, you know, there were more than 100,000 people here in Paris alone, numbers that have just come out from the police. They're saying It is down on last week, 93,000 people. But yes, it is tense to see, at the very least, demonstrations still happening right around the country and here in Paris. We know that many people have been injured, many arrests, fires started, a BNP Paribas bank which had been boarded up in the city of Nantes, which is in the west of the country. It was broken into, cars torched and, you know, fireworks and other projectiles launched at police. So it's certainly been a very dramatic day right around the country.
I was reading some comments from Emmanuel Macron saying there's no alternative and that he knows it's unpopular. He doesn't want to have to do it, but he's saying there's no alternative. We've got to do it. I mean, there's a term limit on him, right? He doesn't have to seek re-election. Is he seeing this as some sort of legacy policy that he has to make for the future of the country, despite it being unpopular?
Exactly. Well, he's a reformist president. He's got 4 years left. He did, you know, promise this pension reform as, you know, part of being voted in. I do need to tell you that today, you know, unions are trying to find a compromise here. These protests have been crippling the country. They penned a joint letter to the president today. They called for, you know, some kind of negotiation, some kind of compromise or suspension of these reform plans, which, you know, we do need to point out were very hastily pushed through using a constitutional loophole known as the nuclear option, or known as 49.3, which were pushed through Parliament without a vote. Now, that then caused, you know, major opposition, not just on the French streets, but also in Parliament. We saw two motions of no confidence against the Macron government. The government really narrowly scraping through 10 votes there to sort of save them. But now this bill is with the Constitutional Court having a look at, you know, all of these minor parts of the bill. It's not likely that this bill will be scrapped by the Constitutional Court, but, you know, parts of it could potentially be, you know, changed or altered. But as I just mentioned, they penned this letter to President Macron today calling for, you know, some kind of compromise. But he's come out to say a little earlier today that, you know, he's more than willing to talk to unions, but only on other topics, repeating that it will continue to stand firm on the pension front, which, as I mentioned, will raise the age of retirement from 62 to 64, which, of course, is at the very bitter centre of this dispute.
Just finally, there will be no doubt a lot of those who oppose the Macron government coming out from a range of sources, and I wonder whether there's the more violent element of the protest. Are we seeing the, you know, anarchists or various other groups joining in here? Where does the middle ground of France sit on this? Because no doubt there will be those who are seeking this as an opportunity to topple Macron regardless.
Yeah, well, certainly. Look, on the Paris street, there's a group known as the Black Bloc. They come out after dark and they're the ones sort of causing anarchy. They're burning the trash that's been piling up, burning cars, burning anything in their path. You know, there is, of course, is a middle ground. These are people who want to just see this done in a fair way. They want transparency and they want to know all the facts about this. And you know, a lot of journalists have been coming out saying that this pension reform bill was not presented in a transparent way. It was just sort of pushed out without all the facts given to these people. So, you know, in saying all of this, it certainly seems like it is a very long road ahead, with neither side wanting to compromise and really no compromise in sight. So, you know, we're seeing, as I mentioned, just bags and bags of trash piled up on the streets, cars burning, and another protest, Corin, scheduled for next Thursday.
Thank you very much for that. That is Sarah Coates, our correspondent in Paris, covering those ongoing protests in Paris. Very big protests there this morning. Building thousands of large homes that can accommodate Pacifica families is a cornerstone to lifting Pacific children out of poverty. This is according to Pacific Child Advocates. The latest Statistics New Zealand figures show little change between 2019 and 2022, with one quarter of Pacific children still living in poverty. That compares to 1 in 10 children in the overall population. Moana Connect this morning launching a 10-year action plan to ensure Pacific children get the basics expected for anyone growing up in a developed country. Pediatrician Tawila Percival is with us now. Kia ora, good morning.
Morning.
Moana Connect, this is a new-sounding organisation to me. Can you just give us a bit of background about what it is and where it's come from?
We've been around for just over 5 years, and we began as a private Pacific research company. We left university and set up in the community, and we basically expanded. So we're involved in research, training, education, a lot of community projects, basically based in Māngere, focusing on Pacific children and their families.
And you're just a private NGO, are you?
A private company, yes.
Great. This, your report, a key feature of it is this idea around housing and that we're not building houses fit for Pacific families. Can you expand a bit on that?
Well, I guess just putting the context in first, our focus is on improving the well-being of Pacific children. So what we've done is pull together policies and research which is out there already and, I guess, come up with suggestions based on that. And it seemed to us, if we're thinking about children's health and well-being, one of the top things to look at is housing. You know, it really impacts children's health. So it's addressing things like overcrowding and housing quality. So our suggestion for building housing which is more appropriate for our big families is addressing issues of overcrowding plus enabling families to live with the multiple generations, which is the way our families do tend to live. So
that's interesting. It's really interesting. So do you think that the in terms of the way in which the social housing and state housing is focused and built, it's simply not thinking enough about Pacifica families and the way in which they live? So 7, 8, 9 people might be in a house as opposed to 4 or 5.
That's right. So we need a suite of houses, obviously, smaller houses for smaller families. But, you know, we have almost 100,000 of our people living in big 7-plus sized families, so they need bigger houses. And there's some projects already. There's one in Porirua, there's one in Auckland, where we've got Pacific NGOs working with the government to build those bigger houses. So what we're suggesting is let's do more of that.
It's really interesting because I wonder if, you know, do you think that there will be Pacific families who are kind of being forced away from a traditional way in which they like and want to live into sort of 2-3-bedroom homes that are provided by the state or social housing? I mean, that's not an ideal scenario.
That's right. And the other thing is we have big families, you know, 9-10 people living in 2-bedroom houses. So that's not ideal either.
No.
No. So we want our grandparents to live with our families. So let's build housing that's appropriate for that.
And what about home ownership and in terms of the ability to borrow and that intergenerational element to that? Is that being considered enough for Pacifica families?
Yes, I mean, that's really important. We're less likely to own our homes than other New Zealanders. And, you know, that pathway to home ownership is really important because in New Zealand, you tend to build your capital through your houses and then you home ownership and you pass it on to your kids, and we struggle with that. So what we would like to see is more home ownership products and journeys to home ownership more suitable for our families. So again, multi-generational ownership would be really useful for us.
Tawila, thank you very much for that. Fascinating stuff. That is Tawila Percival, a paediatrician and with the think tank, I guess we can call them, Moana Connect.
You've been listening to Morning Report Top Stories.